begin with the case of Carlos Matthew Bell in the Commonwealth of Virginia. And we have Mr. Reyes and Mr. Tannenbaum. And would you like to reserve some time for rebuttal, sir?
Yes, Your Honor. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes, please.
5 minutes? Sure. Did you gentlemen get a chance to sign in?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. May it please the Court, Christopher Reyes on behalf of Appellant Carlos Bell in this case. The only issue in this case is whether the Circuit Court committed a reversible error in denying a justifiable self-defense jury instruction. Now, I think it's clear that the judge in this case did commit error in not even applying the correct standard to the jury instruction. He said that he was denying this jury instruction based on it being an incorrect statement of law and that it would confuse the jury. That is not the proper standard. The proper standard is whether there was a scintilla, a mere scintilla, of evidence which could support this jury instruction. And the appellant in this case presented way more than a mere scintilla of evidence that a self-defense without fault jury instruction was appropriate. In order for it to be self-defense without fault, he would have had to be in fear of his life and use no more force than is reasonable and necessary at that time. Appellant testified on his own behalf that he and this victim in this case had on multiple occasions the victim threatened his life, banged on his door, and he also knew that he was known to carry a gun. On this occasion, as soon as he got out of the car, he saw the victim rushing at him and saw him pull a gun out of his sleeve or his pocket. At that point in time, Mr. Bell just shot, and shot the victim. He had four witnesses testify on his behalf, not only about the threats, lending credence to that, but also that they saw him with the gun, and there were two witnesses who testified that they saw the victim throw a gun inside his house after he crawled to his doorstep. If that's not a scintilla of evidence, I'm not sure what is. The Commonwealth makes some good points in their brief that there was no affirmative evidence that because he was shot in the back, there was no affirmative evidence that he used no more force than was reasonably necessary. But I think that the Commonwealth, frankly, is speaking out both sides of their mouth. The proper standard here is that we view the evidence in the light most favorable to the defendant to see if there was a scintilla of evidence.
Counsel, one of the arguments that the Commonwealth makes is that even if it was error in not giving the instruction, that it's harmless error. I presume because of the fact that there was the conviction for the attempted murder and the fact that the malice would have been found, which would obviate the instruction.
Yes, Your Honor. I don't think it was harmless error. I think it was absolutely reversible error. What the Commonwealth fails to do when they're saying that is viewing this evidence in the light most favorable to the appellant. A self-defense jury instruction was given, but it was self-defense with fault, which requires two additional elements, retreating as far as possible and making a desire for peace known. Now, the jury clearly didn't find that because they didn't find him not guilty. But in order to find him not guilty by self-defense without fault, they would have had to find those two elements. And the jury was denied the opportunity to even discuss that because that jury instruction was not given. So the evidence that was adduced at trial, even but the Commonwealth's evidence, is that this man shot the gun very rapidly. Their witness, Mr. Pryor, said that he heard pat, pat, pat. And that is a quick succession. And then two of Mr. Bell's witnesses testified that these shots, 3 to 4 shots, happened back to back to back. So self-defense without fault would have given them something else to think about. And that is the standard for the harmless error, is whether he was denied that opportunity. So I don't think that it was harmless error. It's absolutely a mistake.
Well, in terms of harmless error, I don't know that we have any jurisprudence on the self-defense issues precisely, but hypothetically, if a lesser-included instruction were requested and denied, and the jury found guilt on the greater offense, that would render the failure to give a lesser-included instruction harmless error, certainly, because So applying that rationale to this, we have, just being the devil's advocate here, we have a with fault self-defense instruction given that was clearly rejected by the jury. So implicitly, why is it fair to say that they would have, they must have rejected self-defense without fault, even, just by virtue of that conclusion?
I don't think that we can draw that conclusion. Self-defense obviously negates malice. They did find malice in this case by convicting him of that. But they weren't given an instruction of law that would have said, if you find these two elements without those two additional, that would have negated malice, and you can find him not guilty based on that. And that was not given. So it's not harmless error because they weren't given this jury instruction, which could have negated malice. They weren't instructed on that. It wasn't something that was able to be argued to them. It was totally deprived of the fact finder to be able to hear that, hey, there's another way you can not find malice, and it's if you have self-defense without fault. They were told one way, and that was self-defense with fault. They clearly found that didn't negate the malice, and so they found malice. But if they were given the self-defense without fault, that would have been essentially an escape hatch. All right, well, that negates malice too. And there was more than a mere scintilla of evidence that would have supported that. And they were deprived that opportunity. It was not a discussion that they were even able to have. So I don't think that renders it as harmless error. It's reversible error. Now, in the Commonwealth's brief, they additionally state that he was shot in the back and that he was clearly standing over him and that the counsel at trial conceded that he was helpless on the ground. I don't think that is what the evidence or the transcripts that were read show. He denied that, and only one person said that he was standing over him. We don't know how he got shot in the back. He did get shot in the back. Mr. Bell did not deny that he shot him in the back, but what he said was that he just started firing. None of the evidence produced by the Commonwealth at trial showed that there was some sort of pause in the gunshot sounds. Their own witness made it sound like it was very quick, as well as the other witnesses that said these shots were back to back to back. We can't expect in the heat of a moment someone to remember exactly what they did, but Mr. Bell does say that he did not stand over him and shoot him in the back. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal, if I may.
Certainly.
Thank you.
Good morning again. May it please the Court, Chris Chandler for the Commonwealth. The undisputed affirmative evidence in this case proved that Mr. Bell shot the victim two times, first in the abdomen as the victim approached, and then a second time in the back after the victim had fallen face down onto the ground in front of him.
Well, Mr. Chandler, let me interrupt you because you don't dispute, do you, that the defendant testified in this case and that he essentially said he acted in self-defense and doesn't admit any fault in doing so?
Correct, Your Honor.
In the abstract, wouldn't that be enough to justify an instruction to that effect?
In the abstract, without the second shot, he would have been entitled to the instruction on self-defense.
So is it your position then that the would it be up to the fact finder to determine whether or not a proper instruction on self-defense? In other words, we have discrete acts. It's theoretically possible, certainly, for someone to initially act in self-defense and then go too far, if you will.
Correct.
Isn't it up to the jury to select from whichever appropriate legal options are available? It's not up to the trial court to do so.
In most cases, self-defense is a question of fact that's up to the jury.
So where you have a conflict in the evidence, which probably is the case here, it's not up to the court to select which theory the jury should consider. If there's any evidence for it, even if it's one piece of evidence out of a lot of overwhelming evidence to the contrary, it's still proper and indeed error not to give an instruction that would support any legal theory that the evidence would, in the abstract, arguably support.
I think as a general matter that may be correct, but there's an important nuance that applies in this case which changes things. And that nuance was demonstrated in Commonwealth versus Vaughn, the Supreme Court of Virginia's decision, in which case the court said there's essentially said there's a difference between a dispute in the affirmative evidence offered by the Commonwealth and the defendant, and a dispute as to Commonwealth offering affirmative evidence, in that case that the victim was shot in the back. And then the defendant testified, no, I wasn't trying to shoot him in the back, I didn't shoot him in the back. But as the Supreme Court held in that case, the defendant was completely unable to explain the shot in the back. It was completely inconsistent with his theory.
Does it make a difference, counsel, that in Vaughn it was just the defendant's testimony, whereas here there were additional defense witnesses that testified with regard to the facts?
I think it could have made a difference depending on what those additional defense witnesses had testified to in this case. However, those additional witnesses, none of them testified that they saw the second shot. So none of them were able to provide any affirmative evidence to explain how that second shot could have occurred and hit the victim in the back, other than the evidence that was proffered by the Commonwealth, which was that the victim was laying face down on the ground when that second shot was fired. Without affirmative evidence from the defendant, this is what the Supreme Court said in Vaughn, the jury certainly could have decided, well, we're just going to ignore that the Commonwealth's affirmative evidence of the shot in the back, and we're going to acquit. But there's a different standard that applies when you're asking for a jury instruction. When you're asking for a jury instruction, you have to provide affirmative evidence on which that jury instruction could be based. In that case, the failure to explain the shot in the back led the Supreme Court to conclude that he was not entitled to the jury instruction he requested on his theory. In this case, the exact same result applies. Because he was not able to explain the second shot in the back, the only conclusion was that as a matter of law, he exceeded the amount of reasonable force that was appropriate.
I'm sorry to interrupt.
Go ahead. Correct. So he's even doing less here than the defendant did in Vaughn. Correct. And he's admitted that he did fire two shots. He's admitted the victim was shot a second time in the back. I think at one point in his testimony he did say, he was asked explicitly, did you stand over the victim and fire down into his back? He said, no, I didn't do that. But he never proposed any alternative theory as to how that second shot hit the victim in the back. And the court in Vaughn said that failure to explain that shot in the back deprives him of the right to a jury instruction on that theory of the case because he has not offered any affirmative evidence. And the same applies here as well. Now, opposing counsel has argued that, as I understood him at first, it sounded like he almost conceded that there was no affirmative evidence that there was any alternative explanation for that shot in the back. However, the argument from opposing counsel is that, well, we had sufficient scintillas of evidence as to the other elements of that defense that he should have been entitled to a jury instruction even if there was no evidence to support the element that requires reasonable force in relation to the threatened harm. I'd like to submit to the court United States Supreme Court holding in United States versus Bailey. This is not a case I cited on brief. I just found it recently. But it's at 444 U.S. 394. It's a 1979 case decided by the U.S. Supreme Court. And in that case, what the court eventually held, it was a conviction for prison escape. And the defendants on appeal argued that we were entitled to a necessity or a duress defense because the conditions in that prison were so bad that we had to escape. And one of the responses from the government was that, well, once you had escaped those bad conditions, you're required to take any reasonable alternatives available to you legally. Thus, you were required to turn yourself in, basically, once you got out of those conditions. And what the Supreme Court of the United States held in Bailey is that even assuming you may have had sufficient evidence that they were bad enough prison convictions that you had a necessity to escape, it is an indispensable element of that defense that you exercise any available alternatives to avoid breaking the law. And because you do not provide any evidence that you attempted to turn yourself in, that element fails as a matter of law. So even if you had evidence on the other element of that offense, you were not entitled to that jury instruction. Equally, in this particular case, even assuming that there was sufficient, more than a scintilla of evidence, that he was reasonably provoked, that he was reasonably in fear for his life, because as a matter of law, he exercised more force than was reasonably necessary to avert the threatened harm, that element fails as a matter of law, and thus the trial court was not required to give that instruction as a matter of law. I cited three cases on brief from Virginia courts that are analogous to this case, the People's case, Avent, and Vaughn, of course, which we've been talking about. Avent, the Supreme Court of Virginia held that the defendant was not entitled to a justifiable self-defense instruction because in that case, There had been a physical altercation between the victim and the defendant. Eventually, the victim ended up on the ground, and it was at that point, as the victim was lying in a prone and wounded position, having been shot, that the defendant shot the victim again. And the court held that that was an unreasonable amount of force that was used, thus he was not entitled to a jury instruction. Of course, the same conclusion would apply here on similar facts. In Peoples, that was a Commonwealth attorney, that was a court of appeals case en banc in 1999. The court reached a similar conclusion there as to expert testimony that the defendant argued would have supported his claim of self-defense. The standard was the same. The facts were read in the light most favorable to the defendant, which is the same standard we have here, and the court concluded that there was no evidence to support that defense because the degree of force used exceeded that which was reasonably necessitated by the threat. That was threatened in that case. Same result applies here. Lemons' concurrence in that case and his invocation of the harmless error standard is particularly relevant. Then Judge Lemons concurred and held that even assuming he was entitled to expert testimony, that there was error there, any error was necessarily harmless because even if the defendant had had some justification and that even if there had been some threat when the defendant initially engaged in that physical altercation, Judge Lemons wrote, quote, that he lost all justification he may have had by continuing to shoot the victim after the victim was in that prone and helpless position on the floor. Similarly here, even assuming there was any sort of justification to fire that first shot, by firing that second shot in rapid succession, he lost any justification he may have ever had, and he thus forfeited the right to claim self-defense, and he thus forfeited the right to a jury instruction on that theory of the case. For all these reasons, we would ask the court to affirm. And unless there are any questions from the court, I'm happy to rest on my brief.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Absolutely, Your Honor. As far as Vaughn goes, I think that case is distinguishable. I'll split it into two different parts, but as far as affirmative evidence, they're saying that he denied he wasn't trying to shoot him in the back in Vaughn, and that was not affirmative evidence, and so there was undisputed evidence that he had to have had malice. That is not the same thing that we have in this case. There was affirmative evidence that Mr. Bell did use no more force than was reasonably necessary. And that affirmative evidence is through the testimony of Mr. Pryor and then Ms. Stith and Mr. Smith, who all talked about how these shots happened rapidly. They were quick shots. It wasn't a shot, wait, he's on the ground, shoot again. So them saying that they heard these rapid shots is affirmative evidence that this is something that happened quickly and he was using no more force than was reasonably necessary to dispel an attack by someone with a firearm. In the Vaughn case, that person, or the victim in that case, testified that he felt he got shot in the leg and then turned around and started to flee. There is obviously some sort or some amount of time that passed between getting shot in the leg and turning around and fleeing and getting shot in the back again. The Commonwealth presented one witness that testified that he got shot, fell on the ground, and at that point he stood over him and shot him. The Commonwealth's argument in saying that, well, he didn't have the right to shoot two shots is essentially saying when someone's coming at you with a gun, you better hope that your first shot takes them out, because if not, you better just stop right then and they have a chance to get up and shoot you at that point in time, and then you can shoot them again. You have to wait. That doesn't make sense. Shooting multiple shots rapidly at someone who is approaching you with a gun is affirmative evidence that you're using no more force than is reasonably necessary. He was in fear of his life, and it's distinguishable from the Vaughn case. I don't think that the evidence showed, as a matter of law, that he used more force than was necessary. It's just not the case. He shot rapidly, and that is what he needed to do to stop this attack. If you don't have any other questions, I think that I would rest on my brief at this point in time.
Thank you. Welcome down to Grant County.